Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are thundering down under, actually not really thundering down under, we're thundering in the tropics, which I think is actually Hawaii. And I'm joined by John Flowers and David Strapinis. John, how are you?
I'm doing really well, thanks.
It's a good opportunity to have you on. We, I think, last spoke on Dark Knight, which I think I really enjoyed. And David, good to have you back. You've got a break in filming.
I do. It's a holiday weekend here in the United States, so I managed to escape for a little bit.
Which president or member of whatever are you celebrating in America this weekend?
This would be Labor Day, so we're celebrating unions and the whole labor movement, I believe, is what it's actually for. But mainly people treat it as an excuse to get drunk and not have to go to work.
Excellent. Well, we understand that really well here in Australia. So we're going to start with you, if we can, John, and your initial impressions on the film before we get into the VFX. Just what did you actually think of it as a film?
Well, as anyone who listens to me at all knows, I will go out of my way to see anything that has Robert Downey Jr. in it. So I was looking forward to that aspect of it. Overall, I thought the show was good. I thought it had a lot of really redeeming qualities to it. I was really interested to see the plot within a plot and all the sort of secondary characters. And, you know, there's this sort of now famous, you know, dancing moment at the end. But I just kind of a wild ride in a lot of ways.
Okay, well, we'll get to the wild ride dancing. I don't know if I could keep my lunch down shot at the end. But so generally, you know, thought it was a good ride. Recommend it for people if they were just wanting to see a fun film.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's an aspect of it. I think it's a little slow at parts, and actually. That's a little bit of the only thing, sort of the only plot criticism I would have. I do have a funny story for you. When we first, when the shows first started, you know, they have those three fake trailers to kind of set up the show.
Yep.
And I think I know why they did that. I remember hearing this story about the grumpier old men and how they started it out at a funeral and nobody thought it was okay to laugh. And so I think this is kind of the way to say it's okay to laugh, because the film starts out kind of grim. But the people in the theater next to me who were watching those trailers, I literally heard two or three people in a theater in San Francisco say, "Wow, that movie looks funny," on the fake trailers.
Oh, dear. No, I didn't have that problem. I was killing myself laughing. What about you, David? Did you enjoy the film overall? And
Well, as anyone who knows me will attest to, I will go out of my way to not see anything with Ben Stiller or Jack Black in it. But I was actually surprisingly amused by the movie. I guess my one big criticism of the movie it's a very inside baseball movie, which I'm not sure if that colloquialism will work outside the States, but the term we use, you know, a lot of the jokes, I don't know how much they work for people who are not involved in the entertainment industry.
Well, let's discuss that, because I think that's a really interesting point. But first, I'm just going to call you on the Jack Black thing, because High Fidelity is one of my favorite movies of all time. But I'll let that one slide, and let's discuss
right.
The,
and Ben
the
Stiller
inside
was in Permanent Midnight, so you can just step off a little bit, Strapinis.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
they have done. They've both done some work. Like, I really like School of Rock, but there's in general their personalities outside of the films they do sometimes just do not jive with me, and a lot of the work they've done I do not find very entertaining.
Okay, well, let's discuss the inside baseball aspect, because that's kind of interesting, and I want to draw an analogy here to Studio 60. Remember the TV show that was the successor from the team that brought us West Wing? And that show kind of sank after one season, and the main criticism leveled at the show was that it was too inside baseball, as you put it. Do you agree, John, with David's assertion that it was like insider humor?
Well, I think a lot of it was insider humor. I also think that Studio 60 was one of the best shows on television, so I'm probably not the right demographic to ask that question. There are plenty of moments that were just ridiculous on their own terms that didn't have anything to really do with Hollywood. And even if you didn't know anything about the sort of inner workings of Hollywood, you know, the shot itself was just so silly and so over the top. I mean, a lot of people have seen movies like Platoon and films like that. And I'm reminded personally of, there was a film called True Romance, which I'm sure everyone here has seen. And there was a scene in the end of True Romance where they're, you know, he's talking to this kind of Scorsese-like director, you know, or this this kind of big deal director, and he's like, you know, bringing home or what is it, Coming Home in a Body Bag was one of my favorite films of all time. And so this film has that same kind of self-referential moment where you're kind of looking at a war film, you know, complete with 1970s music, you know, and complete with Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil, which doesn't have anything to do with Hollywood. It just has to do with movies.
Oh,
yeah,
no.
I think I'm good with that. I think that, I agree that it was inside humory, but I don't know that, I think the audience is that literate. I mean, my 9-year-old will point at films and go, oh my God, that is so CG, that's so fake. I think that we do them, I think the audience understands how movies are made. They understand, you know, so much of that. And so I don't think they'd have found it too, well, no, I mean, obviously it's gone well at the box office.
No, I don't mean that it's I don't think all the humor in it is, or and plot lines of it are overly inside, you know, inside Hollywood humor. There's a lot of stuff that everyone can get. You know, there's a lot of parodies of stuff that are just overall very, very funny and very appealing. But the big cameo in the movie, I guess we'll spoil it. You know, Tom Cruise playing the producer. I know that guy. You know, and it while it's a funny caricature. No, I know that guy.
Right, he worked at CAA. That he went to the firm. You know.
Well, yeah. I don't mean that. I mean, I know that producer. I know that agent. I know, you know, the. There's lots of little details of it, like the trailers at the beginning, the fact that the you know, the farting comedy was coming from New Line Cinema, and the gay monks in 10th Century are coming from Fox Searchlight. Like, even like that little, those little touches on it. Ken Levine did a little blog post about something similar. You know, it's so, it hits so close to home to so many people in Hollywood that they find it extra funny. You know, it's like, of, if there's 100 jokes in this movie, the general public will you know, get 80 of them, and those last 20 are really only for people inside the community. That makes it extra funny.
And yet, some aspects of the film are completely unrealistic, right? I mean, my classic thing that I found amusing is I'd just come from interviewing the pyrotechnics guys at Kerner Optical, used to be ILM, for an upcoming thing on FX Guide. And they are the exact opposite of the pyro guy in this film, as are all pyro guys I know. Pyro guys and guys that blow things up tend to be fastidiously attentive to detail. They tend to be really serious, quite earnest. They take their job incredibly seriously, or they're dead. And, you know, the idea that the pyro guy is running around like a mad guy blowing stuff up, I've just never met anyone like that. It's like stuntmen, right? Stuntmen don't tend to look like, you know, a sort of a caricature of... you know, somebody out of Smokey and the Bandit. They tend to be people that really take their job seriously and quietly work things through and work them up. Again, or they just, you know, don't survive. And so I think that to a certain extent it is inside baseball humor, but by the same token, I mean, we can all see how incredibly, you know, if you are really in the industry, you could see how incredibly wrong it was.
Yes.
In many of the aspects, because, you know, like, you're hardly going to hang Jack Black up and put off real explosions behind him. You know, I mean, it's just not going to happen, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was just going to say, speaking of insider baseball and the pyro guy, you know, one of the things that you reminded me of, and this is completely insider baseball, is the pyro guy was Danny R. McBride, right? I believe so. He played Cody, the pyro guy. Well, he was also Red in the movie Pineapple Express. And if you've seen Pineapple Express, at the end of Pineapple Express, he gets his ear shot. Like, so his ear is damaged, and he's sort of sitting there with his really damaged ear. And then we go into Tropic Thunder, and the guy has had his ear, I guess, blown off or singed off or something like that. So I wonder if they did that on purpose. You know, when you're talking about Insider or this sort of Hollywood system, I mean, you have a guy who's goes from one film to another film that comes out shortly thereafter, and in both cases he has one of his ears is damaged.
I think you'd probably find that on a set like that, there would be a lot of people contributing, you know, because you do know your own industry so well that people would be contributing stuff and joking around and adding stuff. And yet, interestingly, in talking to some of the filmmakers, we got a chance again for FX Guide to talk to the guys who worked on the visual effects, and they were discussing Ben Stiller as a director, because that's one of the things that I think is really interesting about this film, that it was directed by a comedian. And he tended to work the way a comedian does, which is they are very serious and they work over and over and over on both visuals and the humor and the timing and everything. So we were talking to Mark Breakspear at CIS, and he was talking about this not in a derogatory way at all, but in a very positive way, that they look spontaneous and wacky and a bunch of guys mucking around and goofing off, but in fact it's a highly crafted process. And I wonder, David, you actually do stand-up comedy, right?
I do.
Would you have perceived it that way, or am I right in that?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of people, like, when they see a comedian doing something and they're like, oh my god, that looks so spontaneous, I can't believe they're thinking of that off the top of their head. No, generally they aren't. A good comedian on stage is someone who has honed their craft to the point where what is a completely and utterly rehearsed performance seems spontaneous, like they're thinking it up off the top of their head, which is what a good actor does. You know, a bad actor delivers a line, you know, it's like, oh my god, mom, I can't believe you're dying. You know, it sounds like they're reading words. Whereas a good actor delivers something where it feels like it's coming internally and spontaneously. And a good comedian does the same thing. Stand-ups will rehearse every single moment of their act. You know, I make no secret, and it's, as an audio podcast, it's no secret that I have a slight speech impediment. And when I first did my stand-up act, I went over it syllable by syllable to minimize lisping sounds. And, you know, that's the kind of craft is every word choice is not taken for granted. The number of syllables, the number of, you know, how long a certain word takes to say is important, because there's a cadence and a timing factor to humor that is not scientific, because I don't think anyone's ever done a scientific study, but it's really true. If you pause for 1 second, that can be the difference, versus 2 seconds, that can be the difference between something being funny or disturbing. Now
that's actually an incredibly interesting point you bring up there, because, sorry to interrupt you, but it's just right on that point. Mark told a story when we were talking to him about how they had a guy in the background who was blown up in one of the chopper sequences at the beginning, and the direction came, you know, make him actually blow up, like, properly, you know, to bits. And so the VFX team went crazy with it, and they actually had him blowing up, and then they noticed that one of the windscreen wipers on the chopper in the background, a real chopper, actually turned on, because obviously the pilot was just, you know, cleaning the windshield and it wasn't a plot point, it was in the background, who cares? And they thought, oh, let's use that. And so they blew the guy up and his leg went over, hit the chopper, windscreen wiper went off and cleared the leg off the chopper front. And the guys in the VFX crew were just like, this is hysterically funny, look how chunky it is, you know, kind of thing. As you can imagine you'd do, you know, sitting around at, you know, whatever it is, 3 o'clock in the morning, watching a hardcore composite of, you know, lots of CG body parts. And they showed it to the director, Ben Stiller, who just looked at them and said, that's not funny at all. And, you know, and they'd completely crossed the line. And, of course, he wound it right back to, you know, the guy gets blown up and his leg kind of comes off. And it is funny in the film. The point is, though, that that I'm wondering, you know, John, if you have an opinion on this, because it's an interesting problem doing these visual effects in a comic environment, because the directive, you know, make it more gory or less gory is easy to take. Make it funny is a pretty hard thing for somebody to do into visual effects. And there are two tones to this film. There's the in-film film, and then there's the out-of-film film, and they both have different visual effects. How did you find the visual effects in terms of realism and stuff? And do you think that you'd like to comment on that idea of, you know, timing visual effects for comedy?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. There are several examples in the film where I have to question a little bit this kind of edict where, you know, the or the statement, you know, that as you said, was made, where, you know, this body part goes onto a windshield and it's bloody, and the windshield wiper wipes it off, and that's, quote, over the top. But then we see the Steve Coogan character, who was basically the, you know, the young director, step on a Claymore mine or a landmine or some kind of mine that is, or trap that has been set, and the explosion there is so out of bounds to me. I mean, it's realistic, sure, but it's just, it is so unbelievably, I should say, it looks real, but it's so over the top, you're not even quite sure what the hell you just saw, right?
Do you want to comment on that, David?
Well, and I think that leads into the one scene which I thought was just a little bit disturbing and had a lot of people in the head, which had a lot of people in the theater. I always saw it in squirming around a little bit.
Right, no blood on the windshield, but let's just, you know, stick a freaking, you know, pike in a head and wave it around and you know, lick the intro. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah,
because that is what I was sort of heading a little, because I was thinking about some of the earlier gross out humor comedies. You know, something about Mary type stuff. And I was wondering whether, well, A, you thought that the visual effects were serving the story. Was it, you know, realistic enough or too realistic? And then secondly, you know, can we just sort of get past the gross outness of that? So, David, what do you think? Did that just whole thing not work for you or what?
Well, I mean, I was actually very, very surprised and impressed with the production values of the whole movie. I mean, I could have dealt with, you know, another 20 minutes of just amazing vistas of Hawaii and helicopters flying through it and such. I thought that was just amazing. And it was a little bit, I don't know, maybe what was funny about the holding up the decapitated head and sticking your finger and tasting it, versus the chunky stuff on the windshield was the fact that it's the guy who's holding it up is the kind of arrogant fool of the movie, and the chunks on the windshield that the guy just callously wipes away, you know, that's then the whole world is callous and stupid versus just our stupid fool of our protagonist in the movie. So maybe that's what Stiller was after with that note. I don't know. But it did have a weird tone where you had this incredibly realistic violence and gore played up for a humorous effect. But it did get, you know, I have to admit, when Ben Stiller held up his hands and they were, you know, looked like a bunch of flowers from being, I laughed out loud because it was just so over the top.
And you're referring about the earlier scene where he's lost his hands in the fake movie inside a movie?
Yeah. You know, I think what it was is that they pushed some stuff to this absolute extreme and it got a laugh. And then other stuff, they were probably trying to get the same effect, but it was too realistic and wasn't pushed too absurdly enough. You know, out that way to be funny. Like, I would have thought that with the head gag, if you know, maybe everything that was inside the head, if after he'd been holding it up for a minute or two, if all that then just kind of fell out and just kept falling out, that could have added some humor to the scene that would have broken the kind of like, oh my god, that is so disgusting. But the fact that even after that, he doesn't realize that he's actually stuck his finger in his director's skull and tasted the blood, he still thinks it's a movie, it's a prop, is kind of what lets that be funny. But it was a weird mix of very realistic gore and violence and comedy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene earlier where Jack Black's character's inside the film, inside a film, a guy gets shot in the head, and there's blood just shooting out in absurd proportions. Like, you know, your skull just doesn't have that much blood in it. It's not a neck where the blood is pumping around. And so obviously just from the skull, you know, you've got brain matter. So it was like a fire hose coming at him. And I was laughing at that because, you know, it was just so stupid. And I think John had already pointed out that I was pretty safe in the knowledge that I was watching a comedy by this point from those early trailers. But of course, as the film progresses, that gets it gets grittier in a sense, but it also gets, you know, over the top absurd at the same time. If we go to the finale for a second, wasn't intended to be that much of a visual effects piece. The opening was meant to be nearly all the shots, and as is the case with films, the shot number grew enormously. And so the ending sequence, I want to talk about that for a second. This is the bridge blowing up, the helicopter stuff. And a couple of things to point out here. Firstly, Michael Fink was the visual effects supervisor. Now, Mike Fink won the Oscar for Golden Compass, did a great job on that film, actually has a military background and has commented online that a lot of the stuff in the film was deliberately done by movie logic, you know, things that blew up had fireballs that wouldn't otherwise have fireballs and that kind of thing. But there is no escaping the fact that any good Hollywood film wants a nice big ending, and their big ending came in this escape sequence from the hot extraction. Do you guys want to talk about, maybe starting with you, John, about that bridge sequence, especially the kid being blown off the bridge, which I thought was a bit risky at first?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the kid being blown off the bridge, that was a gasp moment. The entire theater just sort of went at the same time, you know, just this gasp, you know, what's going on. I mean obviously they redeemed themselves by having the kid be okay, you know, sort of fairly soon afterwards showing you that he's, you know, he wasn't actually destroyed,
miraculously had not been hurt. Yes.
Well, in in defense of blowing the kid up, he was stabbing Ben Stiller in the back at the time.
Yeah, but the dog never dies and the kid never dies.
A very interesting plot point for me, too, because it's like this kid is okay during the entire film, and then we have to make him stab Ben Stiller so that it's okay to blow him off Ben Stiller, but then he has to be okay so that we haven't really actually blown up a kid. I thought we walked a really interesting line in this film that I hadn't seen before, although starting with the weird hands that you were talking about earlier, David, this sort of open flower, weird tendril hands. For me, I was really interested to note that Fink, who you mentioned earlier, was also a supervisor on War Games, which I still think to this day is one of the sort of the movies that you could look to as they just put so much value into the sets and the production of that film. It's really impressive as a film. But that they got...
Hang on, War Games as in the one with the kid that hacked into the computer? War
yep.
Games?
Yep.
See, now that's funny because, I mean, I think Mike Fink's work is absolutely brilliant, but my problem with that, my big problem with that film, and the only thing I remember from it really pretty much, is at the end there's a huge software failure and explosions go off in the room. Now, I'm sorry, when my Mac fails, it does not spontaneously combust. The screen goes blank. And I remember sitting in the cinema and like it had been so realistic, and then there's a computer failure and then there's like sparks everywhere. And I'm like, what software causes computers to spontaneously... And that's about the only visual effect I remember from the film, and it just bothered me. This is my lasting memory from this. I have to watch it again. I had categorized it as being a disappointing visual effects film.
Yeah,
David, do you know the film?
Oh, I'm very familiar with War Games. I find it amusing that that's what you had a problem with, not the fact that Seminoma started a thermonuclear war with an Amiga 2 and a dial-up modem that you actually had to hold the handset on, you know, with the handset mount.
I believe that's called an acoustic coupler, David.
Actually, you know, there was another film around that time called Life Force or something about a guy who, do you remember that one?
Yep.
And at the very end of the film, this massive interpolation of human experience was done over an acoustic coupler, which for people that are under the age, well, people that think MTV is old hat, let me just explain what an acoustic coupler is. You know how you have broadband? You know how if you're an idiot, you don't have broadband, you have dial-up? Well, imagine something below dial-up. That's what an acoustic coupler was. And so you would get, what, about 1 bit a second?
Yeah, it was technically it was either 75 or 150 baud.
And we all had one because we're old enough to, at least I had one. You guys probably are younger than me. But anyway, my point is that I've completely gone off there. But it's funny how people have different memories of things. I just remember being completely disappointed in that film because I loved it at the time in terms of, you know, the kind of, I was a geek. It was a geek film, Geek Wins. Why did they break it and suddenly have the computers spontaneously catch fire?
Yeah, but you have to bring it up to like the even today. You know, the first VFX show I appeared on, we discussed Live Free or Die Hard, and they were, you know, entering commands onto a computer which caused buildings miles away to explode by backing up gas pipelines and stuff like that. And this is like, you know, you got to take some cinematic license with what people will buy. You know, Die Hard 2, you had a plane crashing into the ground because they had to land right now because they're out of fuel, yet the plane explodes in the gigantic ball of fire. What exactly was exploding on that plane? They were out of fuel. you know, people expect to see, you know, you need to visually explain things to people, because people, as a general rule, not the people who listen to the show, of course, but people, as a general rule, are pretty stupid.
I think what you mean, David, is people, as a general rule, don't understand the aspects of technology that cause it to fail. I mean, to call you guys to the mat a little bit on this, The Dark Knight had a scene where the computers blew up, too, where he typed in his name and the computers blew up. So, I mean, this is a pretty old kind of gag when it comes to, let's just show that the computers are done.
Yeah, okay, but I would go further and say that films have set that as a precedent, and you were referring to a precedent-setting film that bothers me. But anyway, it bothers me to this day. But hey, that's not the point of why we're talking today. So let's get back to this film and that explosion end sequence, and let's discuss the music. No, but let's discuss the movie logic of that, because there were obviously explosions there, and quite possibly, you know, fatal explosions very close to the helicopter that would have killed people. Did the sequence work for you guys?
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about with Fink, which is not War Games, is that most of the visual effects guys did a lot of their research, and I think this is sort of promising in a lot of ways. They did a lot of the research on explosions and helicopter crashes and things like that on YouTube. And I find that really interesting. I've seen a lot of things happen recently, which is very interesting to me. One is that a lot of people are using Google Earth to sort of look down and see where they can place cameras and see what kind of streets they could shoot on within a city and, you know, locations. And then people are using YouTube and other actual reference footage for these explosions and things like that. So I think the level of realism that we're getting as a result of just all this information being available is really incredible. And it's also information that's available to anyone. Fascinating to me.
Recently at work, I had to recreate a particular visual effect very quickly. I'm obviously dancing around any specifics. And the first thing I did is I turned to YouTube and typed in a little quick query, and I had like 19 videos with which to research. And what happened is I had something and put it up on screen in about a half hour, and my boss was like, wow, that looks pretty real. And then had notes as to how to make it a little bit more real. But the having instant access to any amount of video reference is unbelievable. It's an unbelievable resource. So
getting back to your point earlier about people are stupid, my assertion is A, they're not stupid, and B, they're incredibly visually literate because they have access to this stuff. And every time I'm in a visual effects room and somebody wants to, and this is my favorite pet hate, they want to cheat a shot because the audience doesn't care and they don't know what's going on, I'm kind of mortified, because I think that the audiences, everyone I speak to assumes that somebody else is the audience that's not very clever. They themselves get it. And I can't believe that just everybody I know is just in the upper percentiles. So I think that the audiences are sitting there and they know when you're crossing the line. They just sometimes don't care because they're in the story, or they don't care because it's just not important to them, that, you know, they don't give a rat's what happens with explosions as long as, you know, the thing that they care about matters. And so the question is, I guess, is the realism, you know, threshold, the threshold, the line of where you can cheat, is that moving? I mean, is the end of this sequence believable, or is the end of this movie's sequence absurd?
I thought it was a weird mixture of both. You know, you had the TiVo saving the day.
I was going to mention the TiVo, yeah.
From an RPG, you know, which was incredibly unrealistic. But the you know, the explosion was too big, and you could take all that, and then mixed with this incredibly huge, iconic, you know, from every action movie taking place in the jungle ever, of a bridge exploding, which I was not sure exactly how that was going to stop the oncoming army, seeing as the bridge was over what appeared to be a foot and a half deep ditch. But the you know, they missed the obvious point for comedy, because you see that shot in every single action movie, and there was Ben Stiller playing an action star recreating it in real life. You know, I would have loved to see them roll over and just have had 1,000 splinters in his back from this wooden bridge blowing up, you know, which, you know, would have been, I thought, you know, an opportunity for comedy that they missed. But they went for the heart-tugging, you know, recreation of the first scene that they couldn't quite get when they were filming the movie in the movie. But it is a weird way of combining incredibly realistic with the unreal, or handling the unreal and rendering it, and I mean that in the general sense of rendering it, in a very real manner.
I mean, we've got to give our sort of, you know, notes, I think, or rather our compliments to Mike Fink, because let's face it, he is walking an incredibly complex line. Is it realistic or not? Is it technically proficient or not? Is it funny or not? And is it, you know, is its very over-the-topness a comic device in of its own right? I mean, it couldn't have been easy to be balancing that. There's not a simple kind of rule of thumb, as I say, about, you know, we'll make the car look like it's really there. Well, you know, make it funny, believable, big and absurd, and yet not too absurd, but technically proficient. I mean, it's actually a pretty complicated job, and the audiences seem to have really responded to it, because the film is pretty much a breakout hit, isn't it, in the US?
Yeah, for a comedy.
It unseated The Dark Knight, so.
I mean, it may be a reaction, but what, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but John, I understand that in the US it's pretty big.
Yeah, like, say, it unseated The Dark Knight, which is pretty unbelievable, frankly. You know, we didn't really think that much of anything was going to do that. I mean, and it's interesting, too, because as of the recording of this show, it has made about $80 million U.S. dollars. And, of course, you know, 99% of that is in the U.S. right now, because it's only released in, like, one foreign, I don't know, maybe two theaters internationally.
I mean, it's just nowhere. It's playing here, but yes. It is playing in Australia, but yes.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like one of two places. I mean, it's really not playing anywhere much at all internationally as of the time we recorded this.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the thing that I'd also like to point out is that we're talking about the visual effects. The special effects guys, the real ones, that is, did a pretty good job with a lot of that fireball and explosion stuff. I mean, the you know, we've spoken about visual effects and stuff, but There are some just full-on mega 450-foot-long explosive, you know, 110 gallons of gasoline, diesel, napalm-y kind of explosions and stuff in this film that you kind of need it, because we're used to that from the, you know, apocalypse nowadays. And, you know, the physical effects guys, I mean, they really did a pretty good job, notwithstanding, you know, that balance we were talking about in terms of the realism of the actors being in front of it at the time. I mean, David, did you actually like the kind of the actual physical stuff?
Oh, God, yes. I've spoken about this a couple of times, that I'm a big fan of doing it real. Like, if you can do it live, do it live. So, that, like I said, I was blown away by the production value on this, you know, comedy, where you had, you know, helicopters flying down valleys. You had these gigantic, absolutely enormous explosions. I don't know how much of those were, you know, there's obviously a lot of them were practical, but some of them, I'm sure, were digital.
Well, a lot of them were actually practical, actually. A lot of them were, like, literally filmed with, like, you know, a ton of cameras and had tons of, I mean, it was in Hawaii, not in in Vietnam, but, yeah, no, it was totally... there was a lot of those big explosions were just in camera. Now, I'm sure that other things were cropped in front of them, but they actually expected to do a lot more digital explosions, built entire software rigs to do it, and didn't end up using them on hardly any shots.
Yeah, it's really, really an impressive, you know, piece of work. If I had seen a regular, you know, action war movie with this kind of production level, I would have been very, very happy. with it. It was pretty cool. I think to an extent that's an opportunity. I think a lot of directors really love to blow stuff up because it gives them an opportunity to play war, like when they're 10 years old, but with someone else's money and with real fire. So, you know, I think Ben Stiller was probably indulging his inner 10-year-old. But it came across really well. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and I should probably point out, I don't think this has been mentioned yet, but Michael Owens was one of the visual effects guys there. Used to be at ILM, but interestingly, he did Flags of Our Fathers, Gangs of New York, and The Doors. But a long time ago, he did this film that I just loved called Young Sherlock Holmes. And
oh yeah,
I thought that came out in 1985, and I thought that the visual effects in that film were just staggering.
I know they were breakthrough at the time.
Yeah, it's too bad the film didn't do that well in general. Yeah. But the effects
actually
were just
it's interesting
amazing.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because you're right. Michael Owens is a very good supervisor, and I think that. I don't know. I think for me that the thing about this film is that there's an interesting mix of really, really talented people brought together. And some of them had started on things like, is it Blades of Glory? The film that I've kind of blotted out in my head. But, you know, the skating one.
The Will Ferrell, John Heder
thank
thing.
You. Had Will Ferrell not done Stranger Than Fiction, I would put him on the B list, but anyway, there's a team that's been developing this sort of comic visual effects repertoire, and the pacing of getting through those shots is astounding, and you really need a good team. I mean, it's just no doubt about it. Like, I guess that's an old adage that comedy is harder than fiction, but I'm personally most impressed by this film's ability to walk this line I've been talking about between absurd and over the top and not, and the pace at which they had to go through those shots, because a lot of this stuff goes through an extensive review process with audiences to see, you know, what's playing in terms of humor, and you just can't have insert joke here. I had actually once saw a film as a audience member, as a, you know, like a test audience member, because I was curious as to what happened. And it was some atrocious film called Boomerang with Eddie Murphy in it. And it got to a point where the screen went black and it said, insert visual effects shot here. And the audience just sat there in complete silence. And then it came back to the film again. And I remember thinking, well, that didn't work very well. And so this film was a film that was rapid prototyped. I mean, they literally were producing temp shots and then producing temp shots and then producing temp shots.
And I got to say, I have been involved, not on my current project, so no one get excited that they're not seeing it. I've been involved in, going to advanced screenings of films and sitting in on the focus group afterwards. And the way we did it was rather clever, which was that everyone else just thought I was just another member of the focus group. That it was behind any kind of mirrored glass because it has to take place at the theater itself. And, the visual effects in the movie were unfinished at the time. And, a bunch of people were saying, well, you know, so-and-so was really funny, and I thought she was kind of hot. And but the visual effects, like the special effects, were just not very good. I mean, you know, because they were temp. They were, you know, sometimes flat shaded, sometimes, rough comps, whatever it might be. But... you know, people don't always understand that that part of the process. So I know a couple of my friends actually worked on this film. My friend Rob Stromberg has a company called Digital Backlot that did a lot of matte paintings on the film. And, I know for a fact that they were going through multiple revisions of stuff, and they were having to turn it out pretty quickly to get stuff into the film. At a lot earlier stage, because you have a delivery date on a movie where the movie's going to be in theaters, but you're trying, when you're doing these test screenings for months and months and months beforehand, trying to hone your edit, which in comedy is much more important. It's less up to the vision of the director and more up to what the audience is responding to. that you have to have a more complete look, you know, a more complete film earlier on.
And let's pick up on something that John said and relate that back, which is they're doing this, as you say, David, earlier on, but Michael Owens, you mentioned, did Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. As in that film, this film relied heavily on roto and not green screen, because they couldn't put green screens up in Hawaii because of the wind. And so you're doing temp shots with a ton of roto, and roto in jungles, as we know, is pretty evil. I mean, John, I bet your team wouldn't want to have tackled a ton of roto on that opening movie inside a movie.
Yeah, not at all. Although I did notice there was a lot of tracking in this. I know that Buju was used quite a bit.
Yep.
Which is supposedly really great at all that jungle stuff. But I also noticed, have you? I don't know, we haven't mentioned all the effects houses that were involved in this, but I mean, I know CIS Vancouver and Hollywood and CFE, and I think Ignition did some work. And then I saw that Asylum did some of the credits in the trailer movies, as did Digital Backlot. I think they did some of the work on... it was either them or CFE that did some of the work on The Fatties, one of the trailers.
I can tell you that DBL did the, like in the Game Monks trailer. They did some matte paintings in there, and they did some matte paintings in the movie itself.
Yeah. I mean, there's just a tremendous number of places here. And
I think we should say that CIS is the, you know, which was formerly Rainmaker, was the lead visual effects house. But you're right, some individual houses have tackled things like those trailers, because those trailers were, you know, pretty effects intensive in their own right.
But CFE and Hammerhead did a lot of the explosions as well.
Mm-hmm.
During those huge battles, especially that the one at the end.
And I think that... Go on.
I was just going to say, I haven't really seen a lot of work from Hammerhead recently, so I was kind of interested to see them on this film.
Yeah, they've been around for a fair while. Yeah. So we should, you know, check out what else they've been up to. But I remember Hammerhead from years gone by. They've done not a huge house, but they've done very high quality work.
Right.
The Rainmaker.
The last thing I saw was Chronicles of Riddick, so I may be way out of date.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't have that in front of me, but I remember them from, years gone by, from I think on around the time of Romeo and Juliet with Baz Luhrmann. But I was going to say this is one of the first films that I was aware of post buyout of Rainmaker, and you know, they split Rainmaker into two, effectively keeping the animation division and selling all the visual effects, which has caused CIS to become quite a global company, quite interestingly spread between LA and Canada and the UK. And it'd be interesting to see, because they've just sort of started to really pick up pace, I think, as a company. It's interesting to see what other work they come along with.
Right. Weren't they sold to Deluxe last year?
Well, see, Deluxe own CIS, so it is branded as CIS.
I see.
So that, there's a buyout that went. We actually documented it on FX Guy. We sort of tried to work out the numbers on how much everything was worth. Actually, we worked out a formula of how you can value a post house, which was pretty funny, based on some of these recent sales. And they declined to comment for that story. But we like them. I'm just, you know, nobody likes talking about the numbers. But, so basically what we've got is a situation where they were bought out, or rather were part of a, you know, an amalgamation. And that led then to the company as a sort of an expanded entity, because CIS itself has an incredible pedigree going back to developing really outstanding techniques for green screen and compositing and stuff right back to the original Star Trek The Next Generation, and around that time frame was extraordinary.
Yeah, and I guess I should point out real quick, I just while we're on the show, I wanted to point out that Hammerhead did some work, about 150 shots in Wanted.
Okay. So you've been Googling while we've been talking.
No, I had it all in front of me. I just hadn't... I just didn't have it readily available when I was mentioning them. Sorry about that.
I think you know, one of the things about this is interesting is, you know, you have a movie here which is not your typical visual effects movie, and was done on a scale that was pretty impressive. But I'm sure most of the budget went to the actors, and, you know, blowing stuff up in Hawaii, not necessarily to the visual effects. Yet, I don't think you could point to a single thing in this movie that, you know, obviously you're going to point to it going, okay, well, they wouldn't set off that kind of explosion right behind Ben Stiller, however much I personally might want that to happen. But, you know, so you know it's a visual effect, but it's a very, very well done, very technically capable visual effects movie. And it was not done by one of these huge behemoth houses like ILM or Weta or Sony or Digital Domain. It was done by, you know, kind of a collection of smaller houses who all got to handle little pieces of it and obviously worked extremely well together in terms of delivering a final complete product, which has a very robust visual completeness to it. And I think that should be applauded.
Yeah, and I think we've got to also point out that while the team was undoubtedly exceptional, they led with an exceptional team. I mean, as we said before, Mike Fink, Mark Breakspeare, and Michael Owens, all three really excellent visual effects, and really excellent visual effects people. So,
and I got to say, also, I have to be to give props where props is due. After seeing a couple films recently where the directors were working with visual effects for the first time and didn't handle it as well, I think Ben Stiller did a really good job. I'm sure he put his trust in Mike Fink, who I've known for a while, who is a very capable person. And you know, but I'm sure he had a lot of input, and I'm glad he didn't make the mistake a lot of directors do, where they push for a certain idea they have, and it pushes it into a very unrealistic shot where the artist who's working on it goes, well, yeah, it looks horrible, but it's what the director wants, which I think we've all had to bite our tongues and deal with at some point in our career. But the you know, the film as a whole looks really good.
Yeah, though, just to give Ben Stiller some credit, according to Mark Breakspeare, he actually, because of being a producer on Blades of Glory and stuff, he actually understood visual effects really well and was very comfortable with the medium, very, very comfortable with all the technical terms, and, you know, really worked the visual effects over in the way that we discussed at the beginning of the show that a comedian does with humor and timing. And so as great as all the members of the visual effects crew were, the impression I get is that Ben Stiller is actually quite visually literate and very comfortable working with visual effects and using it in a way that I guess all three of us would find appealing, which is, you know, to further the story and to not overplay it. You know, I mean, let's face it, the guy is pretty resoundingly successful. I mean, in both writing, producing, directing and acting. And you know, and I don't know how old Ben Stiller is, but it's a pretty decent, you know, it's hard to give maybe some of the credit and, you know, I don't know, whatever, to an actor who's playing comic roles, because they seem like such a goof-off that, you know, you sort of don't think of them as this incredibly serious business person. But clearly Ben Stiller, you know, has got his stuff together. And, I mean, you know, he's done a lot of films. Okay, some of them are horrendous, like Zoolander, but, you know, Reality Bites was pretty good. And his visual effects pedigree, if you think about Night at the Museum, and that was an incredibly high-grossing film. And I believe they're working on Night at the Museum 2. And so I think he's pretty comfortable with visual effects.
Yeah, they are doing Night at the Museum 2. My friend Josh McLagan is first unit director on that, so he's first AD on he was on Night in the Museum, and he's on Night in the Museum 2. Yeah, I mean, pretty big, robust visual effects films. So as an actor, I'm sure he's been around visual effects for quite a while, so it's I think it's good that he got behind the, you know, when he gets behind the camera, he deals with them in such a technically impressive way.
Yeah, well, in finishing up, without being too negative, we're pretty comfortable that it wasn't any sort of standout big negatives for us. We don't have a good car driving shot to discuss going out the window, but if we've got nothing else, I think we should finish up by discussing that dance at the end, unless there's anything else you want to mention.
Well,
let's move our attention to Disco Fever and what had to be the most surprising cameo of recent times with Tom Cruise playing the guy that David Strapinas knows personally, the evil producer. And And just at a technical level, did we buy the makeup and visual effects, or other special effects makeup on the actor, Tom Cruise?
I did, completely. I mean, they did something very interesting, which is they, you know, kept it so that it was still recognizable as Tom Cruise. And just as a note, I'm not to say that this is my producer currently. My producer, oh, no, John Landau, is an absolutely wonderful guy. Not this guy at all.
No.
But I've met this guy at many a party. But, you know, they kept it recognizable as Tom Cruise. But the piece of makeup that I was so impressed with was not the head appliances, you know, the bald cap and all that, but the forearm appliances when he goes...
That's the same thing I was going to say. Yeah, totally. The hair on his arms was just really good.
Well, it wasn't just the hair. They made his arms probably about an inch and a half thicker with, yeah, like, flesh and fat and silicone, which was what it was. But that was awesome. I thought... Not only was the makeup awesome, I thought for Tom Cruise to go and do that, it was just awesome. You know, he poked fun at something I think a lot of people in Hollywood think deserve to be poked fun at. So did Matthew McConaughey. You know, they took it into an absurd track, but it was incredible. I loved it.
John?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. From the first moment he came on screen, I knew exactly who it was, but then I kind of lost that and really started to appreciate the story for what it was. You know, I was going to ask, I don't know, it's kind of hard to ask this question because I feel like I have to tread lightly around it, but what did you guys think about the makeup on Robert Downey Jr.? I mean, it was a very interesting choice, just like everything else in the movie, where it kind of walked that fine line, you know, between a little bit too much and maybe just a little bit for comedic effect.
Had they not had an African-American actor in the film commenting on the absurdity of him doing it, I think they wouldn't have got away with it.
Yeah.
But having an actor there just pointing out how ridiculous it was, and also having it as a fairly obvious dig at Russell Crowe... as the actor, in the Australian press, nobody has batted an eyelid. Everyone just thought it was pretty funny. I think if you'd hadn't had an actor in the film commenting on it the way they did, then it would have been maybe a slightly different issue. But I understand it was politically more sensitive in the US, right?
Yeah, everything in the United States is politically sensitive. That's why we don't let Australians talk about our politics on podcasts. But the...
or we won't ever again.
I thought that actually the banter between Robert Downey Jr. and I can't remember the actor who played
Al Pacino.
Yeah, the guy who played Al Pacino.
The booty sweat.
That banter between them all through the movie was by far, I thought, the funniest thing in the entire movie. And I loved it. It was a... It reminded me of this movie that came out in the 80s called Soul Man.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Which was just horribly, horribly offensive. But they handled it, I thought, in a good way. And the fact that the entire movie they spent poking fun at it was what made it funny.
Yeah. I said something else that I think is really interesting. And here's my rant for this week, a.k.a. the one that you were referring to earlier. I find it really odd, really, really odd that people go at Tom Cruise over Scientology. And I'll tell you why. It's a religion. I can't possibly imagine people criticizing someone because they're Jewish or Catholic in the way they criticize this actor for his religious beliefs.
Yeah, you're missing the entire perspective that Americans have, though, which is it is the wrong religion.
No, but there is no wrong religion.
No, but
I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with a man's religion.
I'm saying as Americans, we in general have a perspective that anything that is not a certain religion is in fact the wrong religion. So I don't think if you polled 150,000 people at random in the U.S. and asked them if Scientology was a religion, I think you would get about 99% of them saying absolutely not. It is not a religion.
Well, I enjoyed the fact that... they were discussing his acting in this and not his religion. Let me put it that way, right?
Because yeah, absolutely.
While I have as much of a problem with the next guy with him jumping the sofa and have as much of a problem with anyone as, you know, his comments over Brooke Shields and and, you know, postnatal depression, I have no problem with the man's religion, and I certainly think that it was great to see someone who, let's face it, has produced a range of really good work doing something that was funny, comic, and back on the acting. And you know, I like Born on the 4th of July. I like a bunch of stuff that he's done, and I think it's a shame when an actor gets lost in some other debate, because it's a hard road to pull back from. And so deciding to do this comic piece, I think, was inspired, and I think he did a really good job at it. But also, as an actor, it looked like he wasn't holding back. It looked like this was a guy that was going for it, that he had he committed to the part, and therefore the audience, I think, went with him. And I, you know, our audiences here responded really well to that end sequence and his whole performance throughout the film. Is there a flavor that his performance was good in the US?
I think a lot of people were very, very surprised at it. I know they were trying to keep it a secret until the movie came out, and it kind of got out before they really wanted it to, that he was doing the movie. But I think I personally, knowing you know, of a fair number of famous people, not to like be like, oh wow, I know famous people, I happen to know some celebrities, and most of them are very, very normal, down to earth people who are just in a weird position that their job is watched by many, 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 many people, and it can be very weird for him. And I like the fact that, you know, not only in big movies like this, but also on YouTube and stuff, you're seeing more and more celebrities kind of step outside their bubble and poke fun at themselves or at whatever. And I think that has to do a little bit with the fact that people are now aware of how movies are made. Back in the day, you know, where you had a studio system, you know, you couldn't have Cary Grant going out and doing something wacky, because people go, oh my God, Cary Grant hates, you know, he's having sex with this woman, or he's doing, you know, he hates pandas, or whatever it happens to be. But now you can have, you know,
you had to bring up the panda.
Yeah.
But anyway,
you could have Matt Damon going on Jimmy Kimmel and, you know, appearing in a gag video, and everyone knows it's a gag video and that he's not really that guy. Or you can have Tom Cruise making a really weird, completely out of character cameo that, you know, he would never do as a normal actor. Like, he did that role because Ben Stiller is a friend of his, and it was offered to him, and it's a way for him to kind of show everyone, like, hey, I'm just a normal guy who can have fun like everyone else. And I think it's great that he did it. I've had actually the pleasure of meeting Tom Cruise, and he's a very, very, very nice guy. A very intense, like, personable guy, and I have no problem with him. But he gets beat up in the press for whatever reason. You know, I'm going to keep my comments in terms of people's personal beliefs to myself, but you know, I think it was good. I think it was good that both he and Matthew McConaughey did it. I mean, my boss did it on Entourage a couple seasons ago. So I think people poking fun at themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I did some minor work on Mission Impossible 2, right? But the thing is that there is, I guess my thing is, in this film, yeah, there is no doubt about it that is one of those scenes that had everybody talking when they left the foyer, you know, in the foyer. That was one of the things that really just, and of course they must have known that, hence the dance sequence at the end, because it was just astoundingly funny and yet quite of sickening at the same time. But I mean that in a nice way. Yeah, and I mean, you know, we all know individually that the second that you appear in public, even doing podcasts like this, or, you know, various times, you'll get incredibly offensive things posted about you and said about you as if you're not an individual. And so I can only imagine what it would be like if you're actually a real bona fide star, and what you must put up with. But I guess I just want to, in terms of this film, I think that it worked. I don't think it didn't seem like a stunt, didn't seem like it was out of place. It felt funny, and I think that he committed to the role and it worked. And I think, as we've discussed, it was integrated in really nicely. Maybe it leaked early. It certainly hadn't leaked early here. It was about as much, I found as much joy in that reveal as I did in Sean Connery revealing in the end of that Robin Hood film. It was just, it felt really good to see that in play. So I guess we should finish up on that note, unless you guys have anything else you want to add on that subject.
I will say to anyone who wants to come to work in Hollywood that scene that takes place in the middle of the movie where the producer is saying, yeah, well, we'll let him die and we'll get a lot of press out of it and then we'll file an insurance claim, most believable scene in the entire movie.
Yes. Well, luckily we work in visual effects, and luckily it's inhabited by a slightly more sane group of producers. Certainly all the producers in the visual effects area that I've dealt with are much nicer people. We like them. They're warm and cuddly. John, thank you so much for joining us again. Where can people see your work? You're actually appearing in front of camera now in that media show, is that right?
Yeah, by the time this comes out, I think that media show, the September 1st, version will be out, and I will sadly be in front of the camera. It's funny. I went back and forth. I thought about it. I thought maybe no, maybe yeah, and then I just finally did it, and now I'm watching myself and regretting every inch of it. So,
You can't watch your own work. I mean, honestly, we all got into this industry to be behind the camera, and some of us have ended up in front of it, and it's horrendous. But you know, at least you're being judged for your content, and you know, because obviously. It's a good show about the visual effects industry, and so we recommend it to people to check it out. I think it's at that'll be the sixth one of the new.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, you can go to thatmediashow.com or lifezero.org is my blog, and I have links to much of the things that I'm working on.
Which Mark, who couldn't be with us this week, actually was a guest on, right?
The last episode of Life Zero was a three-part marathon episode with Mark Christensen, John Foster, Kirsten Sanford, Liana Lahua, and then myself, Ben Durbin, and Laura Lee.
Wow, what a crossover, and some good names there. And what about you, David? Are you doing anything, or are you hunkered down still?
I am hunkered down still. I'm doing a little flurry of podcasting this weekend, but people can find me on the Twitter. You can find me on my blog, www.davidstrenis.com. And
David, your story on the motion capture VES thing is up on FX Guide at the moment. If people would like to read your take on the motion capture night that happened at the VES last month.
Oh, awesome.
So thank you for that. We appreciate it. Lots of crossover stuff going on at the moment. And you are, as I say, incredibly busy, so we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. I actually have gotten more than a few messages from people on Twitter or Facebook going, when are you going to be on VFX show again? So I very much appreciate all the kind words and everything like that coming my way. It's greatly appreciated. And I actually do have a project coming up, Project November, which you'll be hearing about more and more coming up as we get closer to November. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
And, of course, you can find me over at fxguide.com, where I tend to hang out. And just wanted to give a plug for FX Guide TV. We've got an amazing series coming out. We'll announce it next week, but it's to give you a tiny hint about it, it's some really in-depth stuff. Rather than news-type stuff, it's some really in-depth interviews with some really amazing people, and they'll be announcing that in about a week's time. But check that out over at fxguide.com, where the incredibly talented and let's face it, vastly more talented than me, John Montgomery and Jeff Huser, are also there. In fact, that's one of the best things about the industry, actually. I'm sure you guys agree. The best thing about this industry is you get to work with people that are just better than you. And I think we're going to be talking about that in an upcoming This Week in Media, which I've been invited back on, John. Get to talk about working with people that are actually infinitely more talented than you are. And certainly that's been my experience with the guys over at FX Guy. Some of my best friends, of course, but also have enormous respect for them. But that's coming up. And so until next time, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate you guys contributing. There's a place you can post in a forum of the VFX show if you want to give us any feedback. You can obviously email us. We should give our Twitters out. John, you haven't given out yours.
Oh, yeah. My Twitter is LifeZero. Pretty simple.
Okay, because there's some other guy that's nicked John Flowers, right?
Yeah, he's kind of a jerk. He hasn't posted in 2 or 3 months, and his last post was about speaking of terrible horror film bodies and things like that, his last post was, woke up this morning, saw a dead body next to the freeway or something. I mean, like, that was literally the guy's last Twitter. So I'm like, oh, great. Thanks for having my name.
I just hate that he's
Charco.
Got your name, yeah. Okay, so that's not you.
No,
just
that's
in
not
case
me.
Somebody accidentally checks that out. Yeah, of course, I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter. And if you want to post us some comments, if you go to pixelcorpse, as with an S, .tv, there's actually a section of the VFX show, and people do post comments there quite regularly. And I certainly go there and check out what people have been saying, and we try and take an interest in what you're doing. But, you know, probably the other thing, as I say, is easiest to do is just Twitter us, and we're happy to respond, because after all, we do this for people in the industry like you guys. And so if there's stuff you want to hear and stuff you want to do, please let us know what's going on. And the reason I'm going on about that link over at the Pixel Core TV spot is we've got an idea to do a bunch more retro shows, and we want to get your opinion on that, whether you think it's a good idea or not. Looking back at, you know, some of the great visual effects films, as well as, you know, continuing to do what we do now with the new films. And so if you're interested in that, let us know, and we'll go in that direction if we get a favorable response. Until then, if we can just thank the, and I'm going to get you to do that this week, David, thank our producers and researchers.
Oh, yeah.
For the work they do.
You know, the show, you hear us talking about these films, but we really could not do the show without our producing team, Kirsten, and all of our researchers who put together an amazing amount of material for us to look good here on the show. So we thank them greatly, and thank you for listening.
Until next time, see you guys. Bye.